Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 21. Conversation between Manu and Kadama, text number 45 to 47. Hasanam Pravishya Tattita Bharam
Pravishya Tattita Bharam
Hari Raja Sahatmaja
Hari Raja Sahatmaja
Tadasa Muni Masinam
Tadasa Muni Masinam
Tasmin Hutta Hutasanam
Tasmin Hutta Hutasanam
Pravishya
Pravishya
Entering.
Entering.
Tat.
Tat.
That.
That.
Tirthavaram.
Tirthavaram.
Best of sacred places.
Best of sacred places.
Adiraja.
Adiraja.
The first monarch.
The first monarch.
Swayambhuva Manu.
Swayambhuva Manu.
Saha Atmaja.
Saha Atmaja.
Along with his daughter.
Along with his daughter.
Tadasha.
Tadasha.
Saw.
Munim,
the sage.
Asanam,
sitting.
Tasmin,
in the hermitage. Huta,
Huta,
being offered oblations.
Huta
Asanam, the sacred fire. So read the translation to all three verses. Entering that most sacred spot with his daughter and going near the sage, the first monarch, Swayambhuva Manu, saw the sage sitting in his hermitage. Having just propitiated the sacred fire by pouring oblations into it, his body shone brilliantly. Though he had engaged in austere penance for a long time, he was not emaciated, for the Lord had cast his affectionate sidelong glance upon him, and he had also heard the nectar flowing from the moon-like words of the Lord. The sage was tall, his eyes were large, like the petals of a lotus, and he had matted locks on his head. He was clad in rags. Swayambhuva Manu approached and saw him to be somewhat soiled like an unpolished gem. Report by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Here are some descriptions of a brahmachari yogi. In the morning, the first duty of a brahmachari seeking spiritual elevation is Huta Hutasana, to offer sacrificial oblations to the Supreme Lord. Those engaged in brahmacharya cannot sleep until 7 or 9 o'clock in the morning. They must rise early in the morning, at least 1.5 hours before the sun rises, and offer oblations, or in this age, they must chant the holy name of the Lord Hare Krishna. As referred to by Lord Chaitanya, kalo nasteva 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 gatira nyata, there is no other alternative, no other alternative, no other alternative in this age to chanting the holy name of the Lord. The brahmachari must rise early in the morning and, after placing himself, he should chant the holy name of the Lord. From the very features of this sage, it appeared that he had undergone great austerities. That is the sign of one observing brahmacharya, the vow of celibacy. If one lives otherwise, it will be manifest in the lust visible in his face and body. The word vidyotamanam indicates that the brahmachari feature showed in his body. That is the certificate that one has undergone great austerity in yoga. A drunkard or smoker or sexmonger can never be eligible to practice yoga. Generally, yogis look very skinny because of their not being comfortably situated, but Kadama Muni was not emaciated, for he had seen the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. Here the word Snigdha Pangha Vilokanat means that he was fortunate enough to see the Supreme Lord face to face. He looked healthy because he had directly received the nectarian sound vibrations from the lotus lips of the Personality of Godhead. Similarly, one who hears the transcendental sound vibration of the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, also improves in health. We have actually seen that many brahmacharis and grihasthas connected with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness have improved in health, and the luster has come to their faces. It is essential that a brahmachari engaged in spiritual advancement look very healthy and lustrous. The comparison of the sage to an unpolished gem is very appropriate. Even if a gem just taken from a mine looks unpolished, the luster of the gem cannot be stopped. Similarly, although Kadama was not properly dressed and his body was not properly cleansed, his overall appearance was gem-like. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So here we're discussing about Kadama Muni, and Kadama Muni, of course, is a great yogi, and we see here that from the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we get to see the activities of a real yogi. There are many yoga institutes, yoga clubs and societies all over the world. Yoga has become very popular. The yoga that people practice is a farce. It really has. It has some value. But very minimal, because people are not practicing it properly. I saw that these days, when soldiers come back from the war, something like one in three spend the rest of their lives in a very state of complete anxiety and depression, which they never recover from. The soldiers are not quite like the soldiers of Arjun's time. They come back with their war injuries, and they come back with mental scars that they, and it's quite a phenomenal situation. There's an extraordinary number of them just never quite recover. They can't function in a workplace, they can't function in their family, they can't, they sort of very difficult. But the government, therefore, you know, in different charity organisations, I think who's that red-headed prince? William? Who's it? Harry. Harry. Not that we follow these things. But, yeah, he does a lot of work for helping soldiers, you know, who are injured, both mentally and physically. So it's quite a... And one of the things they do, not Harry, but others, is they pay for them to do yoga. You know, so and the yoga is very helpful for them. So even though it's not practiced properly, they do derive benefits, you know, quite substantial benefits, which they can't get from any other medication, you know, psychiatry or, you know, so many different things. So even practicing yoga, you know, in a farcical way, it's still very, very beneficial. What to speak of if it's practiced properly. So here we see with Kardama Muni how yoga is practiced properly. And of course in this purport also, Srila Prabhupada explains that what Kardama Muni did in that age, we can no longer do in this age, and therefore Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given the Sankirtan movement. So we'll look at that as well. But I might read a couple of statements by Srila Prabhupada just discussing you know, some of the things that he has experienced and you know, in his wisdom. And of course Srila Prabhupada lived born in India and lived at a time where you know, there were still many yogis visible if you happened to be in the right place at the right time. So, you know, here's some of his observations. So, now, in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, Srila Prabhupada, this is a lecture from 1966, New York. He's speaking on the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, verses 4 to 12. And he's saying, quoting, Yogi yunjita satitam atmanam rahasistita. The yogi should always be engaged, focusing his mind towards the Paramatma. And that is possible, rahasi, in a secluded place. In a secluded place. So here we see Kardama Muni. So when yoga is practiced properly, it's not practiced in a city. It's not practiced in a society. It's not practiced with others. It's practiced alone and in a very secluded place. And that place is very conducive to one sitting very peacefully and happily. So, you know, previously there's been descriptions of the beautiful place where Bindu Sarovara, yeah, where Kardama Muni, and you could just imagine sitting in such a place, you almost never want to leave. So that's a sort of you know, place that you want to be in, make very conducive to practicing yoga. And undisturbed by anyone, ever. No one ever comes there. So Prabhupada says, in a secluded place, I cannot concentrate my mind in the hubble bubble of this society or a big city. The hubble bubble, Prabhupada calls it. Srila Prabhupada mentions that, he says, still in India there are many yogis. They come at Kumbh Mela. We have seen some of them. Some of them are 700 years old, and you'll see him just like a boy of 25 years. They are doing something, yoga. So they rarely come when there is some they rarely come. They come when there is some special function. In India, there are four places. Just like in modern days, there are conferences of different parties. Similarly, in India, still about 300 thousands of saintly persons. Let me do the maths. Not all, but at least major portion of them, they meet together after 12 years in some particular places. So he lists some of those places: Prayag, Allahabad, four main ones: Hardwar, Kanchi. He doesn't list the fourth one. What is it? No, sure. What's that?
Ujjain.
Is it? Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. And now, Prabhupada mentions, I lived for 13 years in Allahabad. So I was seeing this mela. Although it was taking at least 12 years. I've seen twice or thrice. So these yogis, they are so calm and quiet looking. Quiet looking, you know, very calm, peaceful, serene. And not, you know, chatter, you know, just sitting quietly in deep, in very grave, deep thought. he says, of course I do not know. So he's, you know, somebody said, this man is 700 years old, this man is 300 years old, but they look like young boys. So they are such yogis as it is recommended here, yogi yunjita satatam atmanam. One who is actually ascended on the yogic principles, his first functional is that he remains alone. He has no society. He cannot remain in society. Ekaki remains alone. I have one book at home also, which I've had for many years, which shows the Kumbh Mela. And there it showed pictures of different yogis, and in that book it showed that, you know, this one was nearly 300 years old, and you know, they just look like you know, strong sort of you know, young adults at that, you know, still, you know, they had the hair and everything like that, but underneath all that you could just see a very healthy, strong, you know, adult, even though they're about 300 years old. And so now, of course, to live alone in a sacred place, or in a secluded place that's you know, sanctified, a nice place for performing yoga, it means that you really have to, you cannot depend upon anyone else. You literally have to just be completely self-sufficient. And Srila Prabhupada mentions that. That's also in that verses from Bhagavad Gita. So he goes on to explain that nirashi, that there is no expectation that by functioning in yoga I shall achieve power, and a parigraha does not take anything from anyone, anybody. Who is going to give him? Prabhupada. He is ekaki. He is alone in a secluded place, sometimes in a jungle, in forest, in a mountain. And who is going to give him anything? He doesn't expect, because he is firmly convinced that for whom I have become a yogi, I am not alone. My Paramatma is always with me. Although he remains superficially alone, but he knows that wherever I go, my Paramatma friend, who is sitting with me on my heart, he is with me. So I have nothing to fear. Yata chittatma. So then he concludes. Now, just see the yogic principle for this age, how much it is difficult for us. If we want to perform real yoga system, that is very difficult. We are sitting here, so many ladies and gentlemen. Is it possible for us to live alone in a secluded place, in a mountain? Anyone? Any takers? No? We're sitting here, so many ladies, and you have got outside your New York City, there are so many mountains and jungles. Can you live there alone? Oh no. At the present moment, the modern way of our civilization, the mode of our life, just like I am a sannyasi, I am a renounced lord of life, but still, I have come to a city, New York City, the largest city in the world. From Bombay City to Calcutta City, I've come. So life has become so changed that in this age, actually what is called yoga, it is not possible. As Srila Prabhupada mentions here, of course, that the yogis, the proper yogis, they're also meditating upon the super soul, and that's really the only way that it is possible. One knows that the Supreme Lord who is sitting within the heart, the yogi is sitting in the middle of nowhere practically, and somehow or another, by the grace of the super soul, everything he requires is being provided by the super soul. And they have the there's a Brahma Kumari Yoga Society. You heard of the Brahma Kumaris? And I think the I went to because I quite often go to different interfaith forums, and I ask them when they do their yoga, what do they meditate upon? And whether it's the same from ashram to ashram, you don't know, because there's nothing, standard with a lot of these societies. They tend to make it up as they go. But he was saying that what they meditate upon is like a light, sort of an oval type of a light. Meditating upon an oval light, on the top of a mountain forest, is going to be very, very difficult, isn't it? That light. So you may question that: does that light supply you food, communicate with you, keep you company? It's not really, good company. Actually, Prabhupada mentioned that, speaking of light, he went to one ashram of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and there they were worshipping and meditating upon a light, which was the lamp that Mahatma Gandhi used to use. So he used to use some sort of a lamp or something that had light, and probably a lantern, I guess. But they would meditate and worship that. Oh, this is Mahatma Gandhi's night. So Prabhupada was, quite amused. What's that? Yeah, something. There was some lantern or something that he used to use. And so Prabhupada was quite amused by that. But actually, without an understanding of the super soul, one would be very fearful. One would be too fearful. If you get any of the people from the various yoga groups and ask them to, just sit alone. I mean, they have their retreats. They have their 3-day retreats in, Govinda Valley or something. where they have a nice bed and the meals supplied, and they pay a lot of money, because when the money runs out, the retreat's over. But to just go into the forest alone, that no one can do. But that is actually, in order to, and they meditate, just many, many years, on a regular basis. So in that way, they're really just able to stop, imagine how much time that they're dedicating to controlling the mind and the senses, stopping the mind and the senses just from engaging the objects of the senses and the external world. And just closing all that off so that they can try and meditate upon themselves as a spirit soul and the super soul residing within the heart. So the path of perfection also, Srila Prabhupada mentions how they get a one of the other thing about meditating upon the Lord or meditating upon the soul, Prabhupada mentions the perfection of yoga, chapter 4. He says that having acquired a good sitting place in a secluded environment, the yogi begins to purify the Atma, the body, mind and soul. The yogi should not think, now I will try to achieve some wonderful powers. Of course, many of the people who practice yoga in modern times aren't trying to achieve mystic cities because they know that it's pretty much beyond them, or they may not even have belief very much in that. But, you know, for many of them, they're trying to, sometimes they're trying to increase their sexual potency. Sometimes they're trying to, you know, just, you know, increase their ability to achieve wealth, you know, or to become powerful. You know, so many different things. You know, by their yoga, many people are trying to increase their ability to be prosperous and successful in material life to one degree or another. But this is the actual purpose by which the yogi practices yoga. The yogi should not think, now I will try to achieve some wonderful powers. These are not the purpose of yoga. The real yogis do not exhibit them. The real yogis thinks, I am now contaminated by this material atmosphere, so now I must purify myself. That is how the yogi is thinking like that. So you imagine, you know, if you go to the different yoga societies, people are not thinking like that. You know, I am contaminated by the material atmosphere. So now I must purify myself. And the process of purification means this. So Srila Prabhupada goes on in this perfection of yoga. We can quickly see that controlling the mind and body is not such an easy thing, and that we cannot control them as easily as we can go to the store and purchase something. But Krishna indicates that these rules can be easily followed when we are in Krishna consciousness. So, the yogis, they're practicing yoga in order to purify the mind and purify the senses, which are contaminated by being engaged in sense gratification in the material world. And by that, that impurity means that instead of understanding that we are an eternal spirit soul whose Satchitananda, the soul's very nature, is blissful, the soul does not need to enjoy the objects of material sense gratification in order to be happy. But because we, being contaminated by the ahankara, we identify, I am this body, and because we have so much lust and greed enjoying and sense of proprietorship and all these things within the heart, we try to enjoy and possess the material energy. So that is the contamination. That's what we want to become free of in order to get back to our original spiritual nature. So that's what they're trying to achieve. Again, it is a sentiment which is not found within the yoga societies. You know, people are actually thinking that through the yoga they become better, more stable in their usual pursuit of sense gratification. You know, more stable and strong and successful. But actually the real yogi is thinking, I want to become purified, that is even within my heart, and it is controlling my mind and senses to engage in this material world and causing birth after birth after birth like that. So now, Prabhupada says here, we can quickly see that control in the mind and body is not such an easy thing. So it's not that, as he says, you go down the store and purchase something, you know. So you go into the store and you say, you know, you have your little card. Yeah, I'll get a I've got a $15 voucher here. I'll get that much worth of mind and sense control. Like that, you know, it's just, and you know, it's like people say that, oh, you know, I can give up cigarettes. I've given up hundreds of times. I can give up sex life, you know, like that. You know, so, but to actually properly give that up, and people, you know, when we come to Krishna consciousness, we realize how uncontrolled the mind and senses are. You don't know until you actually become a devotee. You can actually go to a yoga society and you'll never even have any clue as to how uncontrolled the mind and senses are. But if you come to a Hare Krishna temple, even just hearing the principles will scare the hell out of you. People go running, you know, fleeing here and there. As what's it say in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Arjun says when he saw the universal form that, you know, the devotees chant your holy name, the demons flee here and there, all this is rightly done. Those who engage in sense gratification, they run from the Hare Krishna movement like that. So, you know, we're the enemy of many people because of this principle. But it's only when someone tries to control the mind and the senses, you very quickly, as Prabhupada says, within, you know, within an hour, within that first day, you'll realize, my goodness, you know, this is, it's almost impossible like that. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, to Arjuna that by, you know, being detached, so you're practicing these principles of austerity, but doing it by the right means, then you can be successful at that. Now, the big one, of course, is sex life. That's the most difficult. And so Prabhupada follows on in this purport, or in the path of perfection of yoga. He says, of course, everyone is motivated by sex life, but sex life is not actually discouraged. Breathe a sigh of relief. We have this material body, and as long as we have it, sex desire will be there. Similarly, as long as we have the body, we must eat to maintain it, and we must sleep in order to give it rest. So very interesting, you know this here, as long as we have this material body, sex desire will be there. So, therefore, as Prabhupada mentions, that just like eating, as long as you have the material body, you'll get hungry. You know, you'll have to eat. But just as we control our hunger and thirst, we also control the sex urge. But these things are concomitant with having a material body. Now, for some, here, as Prabhupada, you know, some who have practiced in their previous life or who have practiced since very young in the Gurukuls, controlling the sex urge is, you know, they've already made great progress and it's, you know, they have mastered that ability. It's a technique. Prabhupada mentions that, you know, Krishna, he learnt this, the 64 arts of the Vedas. There are 64 different arts, you know, painting and this. And one of them is, you know, to the art of, fulfilling a desire. I think that was it. That, you know, sense desire, you know, there is a, we call it lust, it's a very strong, passionate desire. And, you know, one can fulfill a desire without actually in a different way. So, as mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, that having a strong desire, originally that strong desire is a desire for love. That is, you know, that's really the root of that desire, is, you know, pure love. In contact with the material energy, that desire for pure love, to have a pure loving relationship, a relationship others, which is completely satisfies the soul. That is really, that's the real desire. In the material world, we wrongly think that to satisfy that desire, one needs to have sex life in order to, for the person to be happy in a relationship. But actually, the relationship or that desire is fulfilled by being engaged in a relationship where there is a pure loving reciprocation. Then one feels complete satisfaction, and that sex desire is curtailed. But actually, you know, that sex desire is a transformation of that natural desire of the soul, which originally is pure love or pure bhakti. So, in one sense, the desire is fulfilled not through having sex life, but through finding its pure origin and satisfying that in Krishna consciousness. And as Prabhupada says here, Krishna indicates that these rules can be easily followed when we're in Krishna consciousness. So, he says here that we cannot expect to negate these activities. So if someone tries to just stop, you know, some activities of the mind and senses, it's not possible. You can't just negate, I won't do this anymore. It won't happen. But the Vedic literatures do not give us the Vedic literatures do give us guidelines for regulation in eating, sleeping, mating, etc. If we at all expect success in the yoga system, we cannot allow our unbridled senses to take us down the paths of sense objects. Therefore, guidelines are set up. Lord Sri Krishna is advising that the mind can be controlled through regulation. If we do not regulate our activities, our mind will be more and more agitated. It is not that activities are to be stopped, but regulated by the mind always in Krishna consciousness. Being always engaged in some activity connected with Krishna is actual samadhi. It is not that when one is in samadhi, he doesn't eat, work, sleep, or enjoy himself in any way. Rather, samadhi can be defined, this is a wonderful definition of samadhi, samadhi can be defined as executing regulated activities while absorbed in the thought of Krishna. That's a nice. So generally when, if people do want to imitate some yogi, they try and artificially stop this or stop that. Not just yogis, but, you know, in every religious organization around the world, you know, people will set themselves up as, you know, big Christians, Muslims, this, that and the other, and they present themselves as on the, you know, very elevated platform of complete control of the mind and senses. But in many cases, you know, there is an artificial negation. Of course, there's a lot of trouble in, you know, different organizations such as Christianity with, you know, so many, you know, activities of pedophilia and what have you, because, you know, there is an artificial negation trying to stop something and it just doesn't work. And therefore you see, you know, so, you know, they have, there's a big debate going on in Christianity whether, you know, the priest should be allowed to marry and things like that. And I think, you know, therefore they have, you know, some schisms where, you know, certain parts of the Christian groups, you know, form a new church where they can marry and they can do like this, so many different things. But evidently, in the time of Jesus, that the history books tend to show that it was sort of, it would be very unusual and almost unheard of for a priest not to be married. You know, that was the norm. And that's why, you know, according to various scrolls that were unearthed, the Nag Hammadi scrolls and, you know, what have you, they say that actually he was married and, you know, there was a bloodline. But, you know, the problem is that within the theology of Christianity, if he was married, they can't understand how he would be engaging his senses like an ordinary person and at the same time be someone who's this great, you know, mystic personality from the spiritual world. So they can't, therefore they have, let's write that out of history. You know, there's something wrong with that picture. And our priest shouldn't marry. So this has created a whole problem which is plaguing the entire church, you know. So such a big problem. So, you know, here is, you know, like many movements, you know, although Krishna consciousness is very, very practical and easily applicable, it's very difficult for people to understand, you know, even from other religious organisations, even those who are, you know, the great, you know, professors of theology for their particular religious organisation. So these are very important points, you know, that... you know, this is a real solid foundation of ISKCON, that we don't follow some artificial, you know, process of negation, that we ask people to come here and get them, you stop this, you stop that, don't do that, like that, and not give them some process and some higher taste, which actually happens throughout the course of history in, you know, many yogic and religious organisations, which is causing them to crumble to the ground. And as Prabhupada says, you know, these other, you know, spiritual organisations, many of them will crumble. You know why he says that? He says because they don't have the proper culture. In order for something to, you know, be maintained thousands and thousands and thousands of years, it must have a proper substantial culture by which people live by. And if it doesn't, it will collapse. And therefore, he said they will collapse. And we see that they are collapsing. And when they collapse, they'll look for something else. And what is that? They will look at Krishna consciousness. Because it's just, you know, yes, you can, you know, regulate. And it's very, when you think about it, you know, it's quite common sense that... the example is given that if you know you're riding a horse, and then you know you decide that the horse is going too fast, or it needs to stop, and you just pull on the reins like this, and then the horse will throw you off like that, or even take off, and you know. So when riding a horse, you know you sort of ease back a little bit, just you know like that. Even though you want to stop really quick, you still have to just gently do it. And the mind and the senses are like that. Even though, you know, the idea is to give up sense gratification straight away. But still, even though that desire is there, there's a process of gradually regulating the senses in Krishna consciousness. And that works. And, you know, there's a... Here, Prabhupada gives this wonderful analogy. Just talking about tapasya in general... he says, find this quote. On a similar, note, yeah, Papa says that right, so I'm going to read this whole thing. This is from Bhavan's journal, 1976. It's sort of questions and answers to Prabhupada. Tapasya brahmacharina samina samina damina cham chagina sattva sochabhyam yamina yamina vam. To advance in spiritual life, these things are essential. Tapasya. Tapasya means voluntarily accepting something which may be painful. Just like we are recommending no illicit sex, no gambling, no meat eating. So those who are accustomed to these bad habits, for them in the beginning it may be a little difficult. But in spite of becoming difficult, one has to do it. That is called tapasya. That's interesting. You know, there's a definition of tapasya. You have to do it. So, to rise early in the morning, Prabhupada mentions that in this purport also today. Those who are not practiced, it is a little painful. But one has to do it. This is called tapasya. So according to the Vedic injunction, there are some tapasyas that must be done. It is not, I may do it, I may not do it. It must be done. Just like in the Mundak Upanishad, it is ordered that one must go to the spiritual master. Tad vigyatam sa gurum vivavigachet. So there is no question of voluntarily, but it must be. So as we're describing, if one doesn't get the proper process, which comes down in the line of the scriptures, you'll not have any chance in spiritual life at all. You'll be able to do something artificial. So there is no question of voluntarily, but it must be. And one must carry out the order of the spiritual master and the order of Shastra, that is called tapasya. Just like in our line, a codicil is compulsory. One may feel some inconvenience fasting or simply eating fruit. No, it must be done. There are so many rules and regulations which is essential. It must be done. This is called tapasya. Without consideration whether it is convenient or inconvenient for you, which must be done, that is called tapasya. Just like Rishabhdev orders that in this human form of life is meant for tapasya. Therefore, in our Vedic civilization, we find so many rules and regulations. This is tapasya. From the very beginning of life, brahmachari, go to the spiritual master's place and act like a menial servant. Nichavat, it is said. If the spiritual master says, you go and pick up some wood from the forest, and one may be a king's son, but he cannot deny it. The spiritual master's order, you must go. As Krishna, he was ordered to go and pick up some dry wood from the forest. So he had to go. Although his father was Nanda Maharaj, a village Vaishya king, and Krishna was the personality of Godhead, but he could not deny it. He had to go, Nichavat. Just like menial servant, that is called brahmachari. This is tapasya. So tapasya is so essential that one has to do it. There is no question of alternative. Then, if he marries, then grihastha. That is also tapasya. He cannot have sex life whenever he likes. No, Shastra says, you must have sex life like this, once in a month, and only for begetting children. So that is also tapasya. There's a nice quote here, which I don't know if I... Oh, there it is right there. Oh. Prabhupada says, just on that point, this is from Bhagavad Gita, in the purport, chapter 6, 13, 14, he says, one who follows the rules and regulations of married life, having a sexual relationship only with his wife, is also a brahmachari. That's a very important statement. Well, our grihasthas, they're also brahmacharis. If they're following. So there's brahmacharis in grihastha life, there's brahmacharis who are not married. They're all brahmacharis. So, now here's this part that I was getting back to. Remember the horse? Let's keep that picture in mind. We don't have many horses, so we're going to bring it up to the modern day. They do not follow. People do not follow any tapasya at the present moment. But human life is meant for tapasya. Tapasya. Regulative principles. Even in ordinary life. Just like you were driving your car. You were going to some urgent business. And you saw the red light. You have to stop. You cannot say, I have to leave by this time. I must go. No. You must. This is tapasya. So tapasya means to follow the regular principles strictly by the higher order. And that is human life. And animal life means you can do whatever you like. They keep to the right, keep to the left, it doesn't matter. But their offense is not taken because they're animals. But a human being, if he does not follow the regulative principles, it is sinful. He'll be punished. The same principle, just like when there is a red light. If you do not stop, you'll be punished. But a cat and a dog, if he transgresses, never mind red light, I shall go, he is not punished. So tapasya is meant for the human being. He must do it if he wants at all progress in life. This is essential. So that tapasya there, to progress in spiritual life, and as Prabhupada mentions in the Nectar of Instruction, to avoid victimization by the material energy, the punishment by the material energy. You know, the red lights are there, the amber lights are there in the form of the four regular principles. So, you know, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, no eating meat. And the green light is there. Chant 16 good rounds, engage oneself in Krishna consciousness, and you know, like this. So, by this process of regulating the mind and the senses, Krishna guarantees you will be successful regulating, just, you know, avoiding things in a regulative way and being fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. One will be successful and one will actually come to the spiritual platform and avoid, you know, the influence and the punishment by the material energy, ultimately in many different ways and in the form of repeated birth and death in this world. So I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments. Prabhupada summarized that in two sentences to Satsvarupa Maharaj in a letter to Satsvarupa 1976. He says, keep yourself comfortable so that you can work nicely and there is no need of dry vragya. Renunciation. So he summarizes the whole thing there. You keep yourself comfortable, you know. We have so much work to do to maintain the body, to maintain the temple, to do our services. We keep ourselves fit and healthy, strong, both in mind and body. You know, here we see Kadama Muni. He's not emaciated because, you know, in contact with the Lord, you know, it's sort of a strange fit, really. You know, because he's always in the association of the Lord, as we are with, you know, we have the deities here. You know, we're in the association of the Lord, means we're always so much Mahaprasad, Sandesh, and Halva, and okay, too far. But, you know, one should keep oneself comfortable. You know, not so that you can work nicely. It's for the purpose of what you need to do as a devotee. You know, if you need to do a lot of physical work and mental work, you've got to keep your mind and body healthy, keep yourself comfortable in that situation. Whatever you've got to do, you know. But that's not sense gratification. Looking after yourself like that so you can work. You can work for 100 years as a devotee. You know, you look at some of these devotees, like Kadama Muni, you look at Prabhupada. Prabhupada was, you know, in his late 70s and, you know, 80s. These young Americans, you know, 19, 20, 25, could not keep up with him. Because he kept himself comfortable in Krishna consciousness so he could work, you know, and preach all over the world. That's the example that we follow. Perfect example. He looked after himself. He had his regular daily massage. He had some hot baths. You know, if it wasn't available, okay, he didn't have hot baths. But, you know, he went for a morning walk. He ate nicely. You know, he dressed warmly, appropriately. For he didn't, you know, it was cold outside. He didn't walk out like I'm a big yogi, you know, wear, you know, sort of thin. He dressed up with a hat and scarf and everything. So, you know, one time Prabhupada was sitting and he was giving a lecture, and you know, one of the devotees was sort of coughing and, you know, it sounded a bit sick. And then Prabhupada says, "What is this? You're coughing?" He said, "I also heard someone coughing." He, you know, and then, yeah, he said, "You put a jumper on." You know, because they're sitting there like, to, you know, the spiritual master is coming and they're, you know, sort of, "Yes, I am off the bodily platform. You won't see me rugged up in a nice chadar and, you know, big jumper. I'm off the bodily platform. I'm going to sit here in this thin clothes." My heart out. He said, "This is Maya. Maya looking for the opportunity to attack. You become, you know, if you don't look after the yourself, your car, the body, the temple, Maya comes in immediately and will, you know, disturb your service like that." One should keep oneself comfortable. That is not sense gratification. You know, it's not that in order, you know, one devotee should artificially pose themselves as advanced by appearing to be unnecessarily renounced where it's not needed to. So they can be, you know, a little chubby in the face, and whatever, it's not a problem. You certainly don't want them, you know, being excessively, you know, unhealthy. They're excessively enjoying, you know, we don't want that. But he says, keep yourself comfortable so that you can work nicely. On that principle, you're working nicely in Krishna, that's not sense gratification. Look after your family, look after the body, look after the things that Krishna, if you have a car, you look after it. That's not sense gratification. Otherwise, if you don't look after your car, you'll get a $1,000 bill, and then while you're earning that, you can't serve Krishna. You know, so you look after everything. That's not sense gratification. And he says there is no need of dry vairagya. There's one time, you know, probably the image that always sticks in my mind is when Hridayananda Maharaj just took sannyas, and he was walking with Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was going upstairs, and on the balcony at the bottom, you know, just like we had the stairway here, there's a, you know, there was a large plate of, you know, Hridayananda described it as this large plate of Vishalam. Someone sort of put it at the bottom of the stairs on that little, and it was really stacked up. There was some big feast there. And Hridayananda Maharaj was just taken to, "I'm not going to, I'm fasting." As Prabhupada sort of went up, he looked back at the plate, he looked at Hridayananda Maharaj, he said, "Eat it." You know, so Hridayananda Maharaj was in this mood, Prabhupada was saying, "Yeah, you know, so austere, you know." Prabhupada wasn't interested. Eat it. Yeah. Eat that big plate of Shyam, you know, like that. So he was saying, "Yeah." So, you know, we're very, very fortunate to have someone, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I'll just finish on one little quote here where Prabhupada says, It says, therefore in this bhakti, this is again from the Path of Perfection, chapter 3. Therefore in this bhakti yoga system, the temple is considered the sacred place. The temple is nirguna transcendental. According to the Vedas, a city is in the mode of passion, a forest is in the mode of goodness. The temple, however, is transcendental. If you live in a city or town, you live in a place where passion is predominant. And if you want to escape this, you go to a forest, a place of goodness. God's temple, however, is above passion and goodness. Therefore, the temple of Krishna is the only secluded place for this age. In this age, it is not possible to retreat to a forest, nor is it useful to make a show of practicing yoga in a so-called yoga societies and at the same time engage in nonsense. Therefore, in the Brihan Naradiya Purana, it is said that in Kali Yuga, when people are generally short-lived, slow in spiritual realization and always disturbed by various anxiety, the best means of spiritual realization is chanting the holy names of the Lord. He quotes the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila 17:21. In this age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the only means of deliverance is chanting the holy name of the Lord. There is no other way, there is no other way, there is no other way. And then he says, this is the solution, the grand gift of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In this age, other yoga practices are not feasible, but this practice is so simple and universal that even a child can take to it. See? Now that should give you an understanding of how we practice Krishna consciousness. It should be so easy that when children come to the Krishna consciousness movement, even they can practice it. It's completely universal. It should be that easy. That is Lord Chaitanya's process. Well, they live in a secluded place. You know, what you find, you see with, when you're preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world, that that familiarity, you know, yogis are very rarely seen. So in other words, if you see a yogi once or twice in your lifetime, extremely rare. If you see that yogi every day, you start to see fault in them, you start to criticize, you get jealous of them, oh, you know. So, you know, Krishna is very, he allows his devotees to come and do the service. They set something up which lasts for thousands of years, hundreds of years. It takes them out before people start getting jealous and envious and over familiar. You know, there are so many different reasons. Yeah, Prabhupada, you know, even some of his own disciples, so much. All he did was give us gifts of Krishna consciousness, and still, even some of his own disciples become envious and, you know, criticize him. So, you know, Krishna, we wouldn't want to see Prabhupada, you know. Gradually, you know, people become more and more over familiar. And, you know, so Krishna ascends and he takes him like that. And the same with the yogis. They don't, you know, they're very rarely seen. But if you saw them every day, you know, when you first see them, oh, I saw this great yogi. You see them every day, after 2 weeks, you go, oh, you know, da, 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 da. You know, this yogi's the same. You know, so it's not that they don't have these, you know. I mean, these Vaishnavas are eternal. Yogis live for a few hundred years. How can you compare that? A yogi has a few hundred years, 700 years, you think, oh, there's something special. So the Prabhupada is Nitya Siddha. How do you compare the two? There's something lacking. Eternal. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, just on that point, the Bhagavad Gita says, what is the use of a long life? If you're not Krishna conscious, as Prabhupada says, many trees are 2,000 years old. But what's the use of a 2,000-year-old tree? Mm-hmm. He said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he left this world in 48 years. Shankaracharya, when he was in his 30s, he left this world. And many great personalities left. Young Jesus Christ was in his 30s. Right? Long life doesn't mean much. In a sense, I have long years, isn't it? It's not the goal.
And the gentleman behind you, what was his name? Yeah, you had a question?
I was just curious about seclusion. You said when a yogi wants to go
So we're not really alone inside our own minds either. So when you say a yogi should go into a secluded place, I'm thinking, well, there is none.
Yeah, so as secluded as possible. Some yogis meditated underwater. Vishwamrita, he meditated underwater for thousands of years. Some yogis go into caves, either deep within the mountains or in the forest, and they're just, you know, practically, you know, they're uninhabited at that. So, as secluded as possible, but you are correct, there are, you know, other living entities, and that can also be a distraction at that. And especially in this day and age, you know, it's almost impossible to find, even if you go to the middle of a forest, you probably get a bulldozer coming through in the next 5 minutes, you know. You know, the whole herd of monkeys running for their life, you know. So, it's very hard in this day and age to find seclusion. Therefore, Prabhupada gives the best, you know, better just go to a temple because, you know, that's transcendental and you get the best value there. Say that again. Cities, you know, some rare yogis do. You know, there are some rare personalities, but it's not for everyone. You know, Prabhupada mentions that he also saw, you know, that a yogi would, the yogis would go down in one place in the river. And we mentioned before there were four of the sacred places, you know, where they might, you know, yogis like to go. And they, within the course of a few hours, they would bathe in each of those. So they would go down and then they'd come up thousands of miles away in hard women like that. And, you know, also, like, for instance, let's say, I think it was Gorkhasur Das Babaji. You know, one time he was... chanting Hare Krishna, and while he was doing that, he started, you know, beating at the ground with a stick, I think it was, and, you know, people thought, oh, he's disturbed, something, you know, like that, and, you know, maybe there's some offence. He said, no, there's some, you know, so he was in Mayapur, I think, and he was saying, some goat is in Vrindavan, you know, disturbing the Tulsi, like that, and, so they actually contacted, you know, because it's a rare incident, you know, you don't often, it's very rare that somehow a goat gets to a Tulsi. So, you know, they contacted Vrindavan, and at that time, that's exactly what happened. So, you know, he could see, you know, like that. But they don't generally, you know, they don't display it. Devotees have, Prabhupada was filled with all sorts of mystic cities, but, you know, he didn't display it, but, you know, sometimes these things, you know, just sort of manifest. You know, if you read his biographies, you see here and there little glimpses where, you know, he's operating on the platform of these mystic yogic cities and what have you. So, you know, it's possible for devotees and for yogis, but it's, you know, very, very rare, but it's still there. Say that again. Yeah. But you won't see the mystic cities of Kardama Muni in this age. This is, you know, you won't see this level of yogi. So they have some little, there's some little mystic cities that some have. You won't see this. You know, it's good to see, you know, one of the most powerful yogis of all time, what they're capable of, you know. Literally they can. So that's the wonderful opportunity we get. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Jai.